Hi folks, the following podcast you're about to hear is a little bit of a special treat. Just over a month ago, we were live in the Sugar Club and I sat down for a one-to-one with the wonderful Dr. Austin O'Carroll, and in front of a live audience, we had the best of times. It's been out for about a month with our patrons, but we're putting it out now on general release because I think everybody should listen to it. If you want to come along to the next one, we're live on the Easter Bank Holiday weekend at the Sugar Club again. It's eventbrite.ie. Just search for Tortoise Shack there. Grab your tickets. Tickets are limited, but it'll be a great, great evening, I promise you. That's eventbrite.ie, and just throw in Tortoise Shack. Grab your tickets now. If you want access to them as they're done, that's all done on the Patreon. So it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And the reason we do that is because we've no ads or sponsors. We have no other ways of making money. We simply rely on listeners. So if you get something from these podcasts, please give something back. And there is literally hundreds of exclusive pieces of content, be it all one-stop shop for all your podcasts across the platform, across the network. Thanks for this, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with one of the true living legends of the health service profession and of the trauma informed and just an all round hero, Austin O'Carroll. Have a good listen, and hope to see lots of you at the Easter Bank Holiday show. Talk to you soon. Listen, folks, we're going to start again now with a segment. Just, and I'm going to be doing this interview yet again without Peanut Head. This is the last time we were here, he let me down, and the next time we were here, he let me down. So I'm thinking it's just to do with this venue. He doesn't like coming. Before I do, I want to just say a couple of things about the last few weeks, some of the stuff that's happened. There's an old saying: never try to drink from a fire hose, because there's so much information coming at you, and you just can't take it. You can't process it. You don't know what's real, what's disinformation, what's misinformation, and it's been very hard to follow the news. And I'm sure everybody has found that as a huge issue over the last few weeks. I know I have, and I've been speaking to people on the ground and people in different aspects of it, and trying to get a handle of it, and I still can't tell you what I think of definitively is what is the there's no real account of it. There's just everybody's individual account of it. But what I want to talk about, what's a little bit different, is what I'm actually going to talk to my guest about as well, and it's really interesting because we didn't see this coming in terms of the sanctions that have been hit so hard, so fast, so quickly. The things that have happened that have made, like, you know, Roman Abramovich is selling Chelsea. There's some fellow sabotaged the super yacht. Another guy's super yacht was taken in Berlin. We're seeing, they're wondering if they can get their boats out of Barcelona. There's a saying that we used to say, no going back, when COVID started. We all looked around and we said, oh, overnight we can privatize, we can make the private hospitals public. We looked back, we said, you know, we can pay everybody a pandemic unemployment payment of 350 quid rather than, you know, make them jump through hoops for 183. We saw that we could make almost overnight end street homelessness. We saw all of these things that could be done. And I'm wondering, when we keep saying about oligarchs and how we're hitting the oligarchs and what can be done, it shows that if the world chooses to act, there's nothing that we can't overcome in so fast, so quickly, because it can bloody well be done. I mean, Vladimir Putin had put aside $630 billion as a fund just to sort of deal with these sanctions. And he'd estimated that would last them 90 to 120 days. Within 12 days, today is day 11, coming into tomorrow, the estimate I heard is nearly $450 billion of that is either frozen or already burnt through. So all of the things that they tell you we can't do, climate action, fix the housing crisis, deal with homelessness, deal with the hospital waiting lists, we can do these things if we just dedicate ourselves to them, which is why actually I asked this man here tonight, because he spent a lifetime doing things colouring outside the lines, I'm going to say. And he's smiling at me now, but he knows it's true. I just call him the doc. Dr. Austin O'Carroll, can you please come up and talk to me, please?
Thanks, Tony.
That was my rant out of the way.
Yeah, it's good.
No, the reason we've spoken several times, but what you wouldn't know, listeners won't know, and people here won't know tonight is that I've known you since I was your height.
Yeah.
And I had to get the height dig in. So.
Yes.
But the truth is, you were my GP when I was a kid.
That's right. Yeah, and you might have told me that. I didn't realise it at the time.
Oh, yeah. And I went through that phase of, oh, Mom, I don't want to see him. Right? he's a local hero.
Yeah.
And the reason you broke boundaries and broke barriers is because in the inner city at the time, there was a lot of epidemics. We refer to them now. We historically talked about them, but you've seen it very differently. And Austin, if I could just take you back, if you don't mind, to when you started. And you might tell everybody here, when you first got your first GP practice, what was it like? What was the economy and the society like that you came into?
Tony, thanks for that. I tell you, I'm going to slightly hijack. I'm going to whip you back to the present a second because there's something there to clear from my mind. Just 5 o'clock this afternoon before I came on the show, I came over here. I got a text from a parent of a client of mine who's been homeless for 15 years, who when I first met her was a beautiful young woman. And I remember thinking, what are you doing in here in homelessness? And anyway, on the text, basically, earlier on today, she had a self-inflicted accident and is in ICU at the moment. And I think it's touch and go whether she'll survive. And the reason I'm really upset about it is because this is someone, and every now and then you see it in homelessness, it's like seeing a train going down a track and you wonder, how the fuck can you stop the train? And you know you can't. And a lot of this was this woman had particular behaviors. And I think part of it is that those behaviors, you wonder, could you have stopped her anyway? But also, I think there's parts of things, the reason I want to say it too is because this is a woman whose parents, they really try their hardest with her. The amount of staff in the system, you know, in the homeless, they really worked really closely with this woman. I do think if the system had worked better for her, I can't give you the details of how, but the system tended not to work with her. They tended to segregate her care. And I think that would have been, could have actually stopped this. But also, because she used drugs, she was outside the zone. We have sympathy for homeless people in Ireland, huge sympathy. We don't have sympathy for drug users. And right throughout the system, you can see this. And I suppose I just need to get that off my thing, because if I go back to the start, it's actually similar to the start.
It is the start, yeah.
It is the start, because when I first started in this, it is, yeah. No, thanks, and fingers crossed. But when I first started, like, I'll give you a story. I worked in the 1980s, I was in Trinity College. I don't know if anyone knows Trinity College. It's built actually on the concept of an island in the inner
city. I think there might be a Shanna candidate here, so say nothing.
Okay. No, there's nothing against Trinity, but it's actually built like an island. Well, it is actually. It's built as an island in the inner city. And it's supposed to be a haven of learning and, you know, where people can go in and sit in these glades of learning and things like that. And the criticism of Trinity is that it actually owns up all of Westland Row, and it doesn't allow the local population. You never see the local population come into Trinity. It's not theirs. It's the people from Black Rock and Fox Rock, like myself, who was ours, not theirs. But anyway, when I was there, I got working with the Vincent de Paul, and I used to do these, one of the things we did a huge amount of stuff with them. One of the things we used to do is take these kids out on hikes. And we would go to different places. I worked a lot in Pierce Street. So I always said I had two educations in Trinity, one inside the walls and one outside the walls. And it's one outside the walls that's how I grew to love Dublin City and its population and its community. But we used to take these kids out on hikes every Sunday. And I remember one particular group in Joseph's Mansions at the end of Sean McDermott Street. There was around 15 kids there. We used to bring out every week. They were the mad times. You didn't have to have insurance. You know, there was, you know, anyone could bring, and you went anywhere. You end up getting lost at the top of mountains. I remember this particular group of kids, the first time they went out, they saw two horses and thought they were cows. That's how little they'd got out of the inner city. And I remember there's actually one kid there called Maggot. And Maggot was a real little bollocks. He really was. And I remember bringing them to see E.T. And, you know, E.T., and we're all sitting there, and Malik, you know, Maggot was causing loads of trouble. But then towards the end of E.T., everything was going quiet. We thought, that's great. And then suddenly E.T. comes to the end, and the credits start rolling. And next year, there's this voice from the front of the hall saying, Jesus, Maggot's crying. And someone, and Maggot shouts, no, I'm fucking not. Next wallops him, and there's mayhem in the front of the thing. So we grew really fond of this group of kids. Anyway, the reason I'm saying is that I left them back in the 80s. I moved on to become a doctor anyway, and I lost touch with them. But then in 1997, I started this GP practice in the inner city. And the first thing I noticed, I mean, really hit me was, I had never seen so many young people die. I had never been at so many funerals of young people. I had never met so many mothers who had lost two or three of their children. And it was all to drugs. And when around a year into the practice, I got this phone call to do a house call to this patient who was dying of hepatitis C. And they said he was down in Sean McDermott Street area. They couldn't get a GP to take him on. Would I take him on? So I said, I'll go down and visit him. So anyway, I go down anyway, and I knock on the door. Next thing, out comes this woman, and she says, Jesus, how are you, Austin? And it was Margaret. It was one of the kids from Joseph's Mansions. And I said, oh, Jesus, great to see you. And her sister, Tina, and we're sitting down chatting away. I had to go up and see her brother. It was very sad. Anyway, I went down then. I said, so tell us, how are the others? They said, oh, of the 15, six kids had died. And that was in the 80s from the drug addiction. And I said, Jesus. And I immediately thought, Maggot must be one of the six kids. And I said, and tell us, was Maggot one of those? And she says, Maggot. She goes to the door and she opens the door and she screams, Maggot, get down here. I'd forgotten Maggot was her brother and he was still alive anyway. But it was that, I suppose that just captured to me how the drugs, I always call it the hidden plague. It had swept through the inner city in the 80s. Swept. I knew nothing about it. I had no idea about it.
Because you were a posh boy.
I was a posh boy from the south side, from Black Rock. And I had no idea of the impact of that in the inner city, and it had devastated the inner city. And it's a testament to the community, that the community managed to maintain its sense of solidarity and its sense of humor through all of that.
Well, I'll tell you a little story that I remember as a teenager down on Brunswick Street. They used to, obviously, if people were homeless, they always had problems with their feet.
Yeah.
And this man introduced a chiropodist. And just saying it out loud now, because he was a bleeding what? A chiropa what? Everybody there, I'm going to get my feet done. But it was life changing for a lot of people. A simple thing like that I remember it as a teenager going, and I couldn't say the word back then, and I can't really say it now. But nonetheless, that was in there. But I suppose when you started, the drug epidemic was working its way through those communities. Now we see it, you know, it's very disappointing to see some of the stuff that's happened recently, where it's Frank Fien's talk again about the war on drugs nonsense, the idea of the Citizens' Assembly being kicked out. And realistically, if they can kick it out for another year, it won't happen until the next government. So they're not serious about it, Austin. They can't be serious about it. And yet again, it's a class issue. We mentioned, you know, you said it about coming from a good background, but it is a class issue as well. Because people who can afford to get treatment, but others who can't, Jesus, it might be easier to do that, use those drugs rather than exist in the world and live in trauma.
Well, I think what happens is I call it the double fuck.
What, the triple fuck?
Well, the triple fuck's a different one. This is the double fuck. Double fuck is we create poverty and people are born into poverty, and we fuck them over because we created poverty. We chose poverty from our political system. And once you choose inequality, you choose poverty. That's the first fuck. And the second fuck is you blame the person for the poverty and for the effects of the poverty. So you see our Taoiseach going out and says, I represent people who get up early in the morning. And I thought, that's great. He represents, you know, because homeless people get up at 7 o'clock in the morning. I thought, that's great. And, but actually, obviously, he was saying he represented the working people, implying that he worked, you know, it was a direct hit at anyone in poverty that somehow you didn't get up early enough in the morning and push yourself. So that was a put down in poverty. And we always, I mean, it is well known, all the statistics show that a lot of people think people are in poverty because they just don't get up and work hard.
They're not worthy.
They're not working.
We convict the poor of poverty.
We convict, exactly, yeah. We blame them for the thing we caused in ourselves. And the second part is that the effects of poverty is, I mean, homelessness is an effect of poverty. I mean, the vast majority of people who are homeless come from poverty. And drug addiction. Like, I go to groups, I go to medical students, and I say to them, like a class of 150, and I say, how many of you know someone who is a heroin user, an IV heroin user? And you might find four or five people put their hands up. And I say, many of you know someone who's died of a drug overdose because of heroin use. And you might find one person, you might find none. You walk into an inner city primary school and you say that same question to everyone. Every single kid will put their hand up saying, I know a drug user. And every single kid will put their hand up saying, they know someone who's died from drug use. Because drug use is due to poverty. And that's the double fuck, you know, because there is no sympathy for drug users. Like, I know a charity whose main work is with drug users, and they raise all their money for charity through through homelessness. They don't do it through drug use because they know they get no money for drug use. We don't have any sympathy. And so I think it is a class issue. And I think drug use is a result of the creation of classes, and then we blame them. And so there's, like, I mean, for example, we're still waiting on the supervised injecting centre. That should be an ages ago. Yeah, we should have decriminalisation. We need to be looking at a non-blame approach to drug addiction.
Well, look, I mean, look, if you've listened to this podcast, you know it's something I return to time and time and time and time again since the outset. We've, you know, only recently spoke to Eoghan Reardon, spoke to Nessa Hurrigan, spoke to Lynn Rowan, all people who lay it out. We spoke to Nuno Capaz, who was head of the Dissuasion Commission in Lisbon, and it's shown how it's slashed over that overdose deaths. And we know, though, every 24 hours that we delay, someone will die in this country. But if I can bring it then to what I opened before you came up on stage, you were leading the HSC response in Dublin to the pandemic.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, all of the things that you were told we couldn't do, Austin, all of these people who couldn't get support to, we couldn't do the wraparound services, all of these things, you could.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting because, I mean, when COVID first was coming, we were terrified in the homeless community because we thought, you know, homeless, you know, the first thing is homeless people, they live in places where there's crowding. They're living in dormitories and hostels. They hang around together. They go into clinics together. So, you know, there is constantly in groups. So we thought it's going to sweep through the homeless community. And second thing is, if you know, the sickest community in the world, in Ireland, are the homeless community. One in 20 of HIV, one in 3 of hepatitis C. They have much higher rates of all the illnesses you can think of. 1 in 2 of depression, and 1 in 3 of attempted suicide at some stage in their life. So look, you know, all the statistics show homeless people really are the most vulnerable group. So we thought this is a disaster waiting to happen. Now, fair play, the HSE and the DRHE, the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, got together.
No, I'm not very fond of, but go on.
Yeah. Well, they got together and they actually started working together and really closely. And next thing, all these things started to happen. So firstly, what to do is we got a number of services set up, medical services to start identifying people who were sick and testing them. Then we got a unit set up, which was specifically to isolate people who were homeless who were COVID positive. And it was a nurse run, really well run unit. And then what we did is this thing, which was quite reasonably unique to Ireland and England, where we identified everybody who was vulnerable. We created this scoring system where we got people by age. So if you were 70, you got 5 points. If you're 60 to 70, you got 4 points, etc. And then if you had medical condition, if you had HIV, you got 4 points. If you had diabetes, 4 points. Lung disease, 3 points, etc. We created this scoring system and we scored everyone in homelessness. And everyone who was above 1 point was put into their own unit with their own house, with their own front door. Not house, but their own apartment.
They all had their own front door.
Own front door.
And I want to remind people that the phrase I use all the time is that the path to dignity leads through your own front door.
Absolutely. Having your own front door. Because from a COVID point of view, but I'll come back to the other part, from a COVID point of view, was massive. So, as well as doing that, we found that a lot of people, because they were isolated, a lot of people used drugs. The next thing, how would we expect them to stay in and isolate if they're using drugs when we don't have the services for them? So next thing, we suddenly got a release of services. So you had to wait 12 weeks for methadone treatment. We got it reduced to 3 days overnight, which asked the question, why wasn't it done earlier? We got benzo detoxes, alcohol detoxes. Suddenly we had all these things to allow people to stay in. It was so successful that by January of last year, when the rate in the general population was 5%, the rate in the homeless population was 2.5%, and in the shielding units was less than 1%. Now, to contrast that, in Paris, 50% of homeless people got COVID, and in the US and Boston, 30% got COVID. So it was a dramatic improvement, and it was a dramatic success. And I think, I mean, they deserve the credit. I have more sympathy towards the DRHG and HSE. I think sometimes they tend to be punching bags, and I feel sorry for them. There's a lot of good people there.
That's another podcast.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of really good people who are really good.
I'm not saying there aren't. Absolutely not. And I'm not saying, but there has been issues, and we still attach shame in much of what it's done, and shame still pervades in some of how it's done. You know, how it's, you have people going out and saying, I saw a guy with two sleeping bags.
Yeah, see, to me, it's not the DRHG. I think it's the political masters, because the DRHG is only working what hand it's dealt with.
Okay.
And it's dealt a hand of so much housing. And I mean, one of the interesting things was the DRHG could do much more in the pandemic because the rental market collapsed. And when the rental market collapsed, all these rental properties came up available. So they suddenly were able to rent all this extra property. And that showed to me that the economic policies, and they also stopped kicking renters out. You weren't allowed to.
Yeah, we'd rent evictions and all,
exactly.
We'd an eviction freeze, rent increase ban, and we got our homelessness below 10,000 for the first time.
Absolutely,
in 18 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they went, oh, and by the way, we want you to ignore the evidence of your own eyes, and we're going to implement those things that were making things worse.
Yeah.
And now we're going that way, that direction again. So my question to you is, what the...
Give in. You know, absolutely. Because just to clarify, the shielding unit was really interesting. It wasn't just that they were protected from COVID; their mental health improved.
Yeah.
They you go out and visit some of these shielding units. There's one in Donabate, and like there was all these people, and there were a mixture of homeless people. Some were drug users, some were alcoholics, some were migrants who had ended up in homelessness. And it was just, but they were all a community, and they all talked about how their mental health and their physical health improved. Cliona Ni Chaile and James has said there was less people going into James's for general reasons, not just COVID.
Cliona was afraid that some of the people that she saw were her irregular, something had happened to them because she hadn't seen them. And then when the people reached out, they went, oh no, I've never been better.
Yeah,
I've never had the services at my doorstep. I've never been I've never seen the resources put in this way. And some of those people, it actually helped change, turn their lives around.
Absolutely, and going back to the thing, they had their own front door, and that's about respect, giving your sense of respect to having your own front door. So unfortunately, now the tourists are coming back, so suddenly the rental market wants to kick out the place where homeless people are, and so suddenly those shielding units are under threat. They're still there, and they're still holding on to them, so hopefully we can keep them on for the long term, but there is a significant threat. Rent evictions are now going back on. The numbers are creeping up again. So you're right, we didn't learn. But we always knew beforehand what was causing this. It was the economic policy, which doesn't protect renters, which promotes, doesn't allow people maintain in hostels, and doesn't actually give the funding or the legislation that allows us to get social housing, which will allow house these people.
Can I ask you, I'm going to totally change tack for a moment. Can I ask you a personal question? The last time when we actually recorded, we've spoken several times, but the last time we recorded, you said you never saw yourself as a person. You used to look around and someone say, oh, this guy, there's a person here with a disability. And you used to say, who are you talking about? Here's the question. Was that your mother's voice talking, or was that you?
No, I think, I didn't even see myself as little. You were talking about my size earlier on. Recently, I had a client come in to me, a number of months ago, and he was looking for something off me, some addictive medication, and I was saying, no, I'm really sorry. But anyway, he got really mad with me. He went out to the waiting room and he says, that's a little fucking bollocks of a cunt in there, out in the middle of the waiting room. And I opened the door and I shouted, I am not little. So I'm in denial of my size, never mind my disability. No, the way I describe that, I have thalidomide, for anyone who doesn't know. My mother, thalidomide was the drug that caused you to have short legs or arms. And You only had to take one tablet for, you could end up with no limbs on one tablet. My mother took two tablets and I ended up affected by thalidomide. And so I was brought through the mainstream system. I was lucky not to have to end up in the special school system or the rehabilitation model. And people often say to me, I don't think of you as being disabled. And I'd say, I don't think of myself as being disabled. And I think it is a compliment.
It's the Paralympian speaks.
Yeah. So I ended up, but I got involved later on with the disability movement. And I really realized what was happening for me is, I'm actually really interested in stigma. It's one thing I'm really interested in. What had actually happened was, why the fuck was I saying I didn't see myself as disabled? I obviously am disabled. And it realized then that what happened was, I had my head that disabled means unsuccessful, unattractive, somehow a lesser human being. So, and that's the power of stigma. Rather than say, actually, I am attractive, I am successful, I'm not a lesser human being. Rather than change the concept of disability, I changed me and said, I don't think of myself as disabled. And that's what other people were doing. And I don't blame them no more than I blame myself. That is the power of stigma. It's in deep, in-depth in us. You don't even realize that you're carrying stigma. So I've now believed that there is no such thing as prejudice-free. It's just being prejudice-aware. And that, like, so you have to be aware of your prejudices. They are always there. So sometimes I'm talking to a young lad and I'm giving out to him and I realize I wouldn't talk to a 50-year-old businessman like this. And I say, hold on, I'm sorry. Because I realize that that's my prejudice coming up because he's homeless and I think I can treat him differently. So, yeah.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's just, the reason I ask is because I know you were driven to do so much. You've such a, like, I mean, when I said Paralympian, like, Austin represented Ireland as a rower and in sailing.
Yeah.
I mean, the stories are just phenomenal. But back to the evidence of our own eyes and what they want us to ignore now. If we were to hand you the keys to the kingdom and you said to me that, like, would we start with trauma? Do we start with addiction? Do we start with homelessness, or do we have to just work a multidisciplinary tactic now?
If you ask me, if I had a magic wand, I'd teach every child about trauma-informed care. I don't know if anyone knows what trauma-informed care. Trauma-informed care is, I mean, it's a science around to something that we all know. It's basically they've identified that people who've experienced trauma as a child, and they've identified a series of particular traumas. That if the more of these traumas you experience as a child, the more likely you're to end up to die up to 20 years younger, more likely you're to have every single disease you can think of, mental or physical, the more likely you're to end up incarcerated, the more likely you're to end up being a victim or a perpetrator of violence, being a drug user or being homeless. And of course, all the evidence shows that people born into poverty have far higher levels of trauma. And the reason I would teach trauma-informed care is because it teaches you sympathy, or not empathy, not sympathy, because sympathy is charitable. It teaches you empathy. And I think we don't have empathy for people. So it means that, I'll give you an example of trauma-informed care. I have, in my place where I work with homeless people, around 4 weeks, 6 weeks ago, there was a guy in the waiting room and with his partner, and something was said, and he just blew up. My two lads, Tommy and John, who worked for me, had to somehow manage to get him outside the front door. He then smashed down the front door. He then assaulted someone on the pavement. He then went over and assaulted someone across the road. And along came a guard and the guards and took him off. And the next day, my staff came and said, Austin, we think we can work with that guy. And that's trauma-informed care, because they know that that person's reactions, he is reacting as, when I'm fairly certain this guy comes from a background where he saw a lot of violence as a child. And the way he learned to defend himself was to explode and stay angry. Because that's, you know, if you imagine rules are enforced with stick and fist, you have to survive. And that's how you survive, by learning to explode. It keeps you safe. And when you see a person like that, so when we see someone like that, you almost go back and see a child having a tantrum and hasn't learned how to control it. And that allows you to have empathy for that person. And that's why my staff had empathy, and I was really proud of them. Now, 2 weeks later, the toilet door was knocked down by a different guy, and they come and say, I can work with this guy. And I said, that's fine. As long as you have a fund for replacing doors, I don't care who you work with.
I've obviously... Sharon Lambert is like, she's amazing when it comes to trauma-informed design and how we talk about these things. And I know, and I'm gonna plug the lads doing the work on the two Norris with the work that they've done in educating people who want to listen to it, you know. And But when it comes to that, when we talk in those terms, are we ready to have it as a society when we still continuously see people who are ne'er-do-wells, we say, or they're undeserving poor? And yet again, we're back at this situation whereby when you have a government that has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity right now, because the Citizens' Assembly was in the programme for government and they sat on their hands and they said, we're going to do this thing on this and this thing on this, and we'll do the other one in maybe 2023.
Yeah.
I mean...
No, first of all, I think to me is the one thing I've always said is really annoys me about the whole thing about we don't talk about politics anymore. We talk about economics. Mm. You know, you see at RTE, everything comes back to what's the impact on the economy. Everything, and you go on to radio show, and they bring on economists. They bring on, and it's all about
Eddie Hobbs.
Yeah, exactly. It's just all feckin' economists. And I always think is, you know, first of all, it's as if we're trying to create an economy to serve an economy, and then we're trying to create a society that serves that economy. We should be talking about what type of society we have first, and what type of society we want, and then we can frame the economy to serve that society. In terms of the idea of, for example, I think they are kicking things down the road. I think, again, it's not on their priority list. I mean, decriminalization in Portugal, all the evidence shows that, everyone does not, just to clarify, because people get confused between legalization and decriminalization. Do you mind me going?
They shouldn't, because we talk about all of it, but go on.
Well, I do decriminalization for dummies. I sit down, I tell medical students, I say to them, listen, you know, if you were to legalize heroin tomorrow, what would happen? And they say, oh, it'd be terrible. And I said, well, no, think this through. I said, if you legalized heroin, you'd be able to go to your local shop and buy it very cheaply. So you wouldn't have to rob to buy it, okay? So you wouldn't now have to get involved in crime. Secondly, if you went to the shop, it would be packaged in a unit that you'd be clean, and you'd probably get naloxone with it, and you'd get it so that you'd be able to stay safe with yourself. You wouldn't have to go down a back alley to inject it. You could do it with your friends. So if there's an accident, someone's there to help you. I said, and because it would be like alcohol, you know, your family won't get rid of you. You won't lose your job. So I was saying this, people don't realize, now I'm not saying legalize heroin, but people don't realize that a lot of the bad effects of heroin come from the fact that it's illegal. Now, if you were to legalize, like alcohol was very similar, because Al Capone was the gangs that involved with illegal hooch. Yeah. And alcohol had the exact same problems as heroin had. Now, I don't want to legalize heroin, because if you legalize heroin, the problem is more people will become addicted. However, there is a midpoint. So I'm against legalization, but decriminalization is where you don't find people who are carrying heroin for personal use or drugs for personal use and put them into the criminal system. You recognize that that is going to just make the problem worse. It's going to cause them to end up engaged in more crime, create links in crime, and feel worse about themselves. You link them into health services. And the evidence from Portugal where this has been announced is that will reduce the death rate. It'll reduce the cost of the criminal system. And it will improve the health of the community in general.
But you see, you said we deal with in economic terms, and that's what they don't factor in is the cost of spite, because economically it would make more sense to go your model. It's cheaper. Yeah. Than actually having to have ambulances running around the city to deal with overdoses.
Yeah.
It's cheaper to actually have it regulated in a certain area or in a safe injecting center, whatever phraseology you want to put on it. People get, you know, there's a lot of, we don't attach stigmas to this. It's cheaper to take it as a health-led approach as opposed to go through the criminal justice system, which employs police, employs solicitors, employs judges, all of those things. It's a lot cheaper. But the cost of spite, where we went back to when this conversation started, is they don't deserve it because they're somehow unworthy of that. So we will pay that price as a society to say that your drug use or drug abuse is a failing in someone.
Yeah. And again, it is ultimately classist because it's the people who are saying that are from the middle class.
Well, I mean, the Tarnished has said, he admitted he took drugs. It was okay. Everybody shrugged and got on with it. But if someone did that from Ballymun, you'll hear the J word thrown at them immediately.
Yeah. And, yeah, so, Yeah, and that goes back to the idea of trauma-informed care, is that if everyone saw the causes of drug addiction lies in trauma, you'd have that empathy. And even like I was saying, I was given out about the fact that we have the economic paradigm, and here's me and us doing it, actually. We have to almost say, the reason you should introduce decriminalization because it makes economic sense. Actually, it's just the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Austin, last thing I want to ask you is ultimately, do you think society is ready, though? Like, do you think society is, like, we saw with repeal, we saw with marriage equality, that society was already 10 years ahead of where the politicians were in terms of this. Do you think we're ready to have that conversation where we're actually going to have a health-led approach, trauma-informed, as you put it, to drug use? And again, not all use is abuse, okay?
Yeah.
Not everybody's a problematic user of certain drugs. There's many people here enjoying a drug this evening of some form. So, you know, it's not all abuse. Are society way ahead of where the politics is?
I tell you what gives me hope is that, you know, like, and in a way where you were talking about it previous, you know, the way attitudes in the previous session on queer pop, about the way attitudes have changed since the 70s. And, you know, like, it was such anti-woman back then. It was so anti-gay, and it was so anti even single mothers. Like, I remember working in a maternity hospital where you had a pink chart for the married and a blue chart for the singles. But that has all changed. And, you know, so in other words, now, and I look at my daughter and son, and they are so fluid in their conversation. Like, I got a bit caught left field by the whole transgender because I thought, geez, I'm on top of everything. And suddenly fucking transgender comes up. And, you know, I have to go reevaluate all I was thinking about before. And so they're all on top of that. And so, like, there is a huge amount of attitudinal change. Mm. I do think the hardcore will be when we can talk about drug addiction with an empathic way and recognize it comes from trauma and recognize that it's not about personal failing. So I do hope, and that's why I say we need to go back to the schools and educate, because it is about, it's not just about government policy. It's not just about change in services. It's about a whole attitudinal change to what's happening down in these areas of deprivation. And until we change those attitudes, people like the woman I was just talking about are going to end up dying. And the communities that I'm working with are going to end up having mothers at funerals that they shouldn't be at. Yeah.
I'm going to leave it there. I just want to thank you for coming, doing this tonight. As I said, I've known you since I was a kid. It's always been a pleasure and a privilege to share some time with you. But thanks for the work you guys do. Thanks for the work that the people that you've actually educated do as well. So they go out into the world. It's not just you. There's a whole crew. Mm. But I really appreciate it. And honestly, folks, it's don't let anybody tell you that one man can't make a difference, because this man has made a difference in so many communities.
Well, they had the love in the previous one, so I'm going to have to do the love in here. So I think you're too great, Tony. As well.
Thanks, folks.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.